Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods, with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, R.J. Cutler, assistant to the director on Broadway and in the final workshop.
Once upon a time.
R.J. Cutler worked as assistant director to James Lapine on Into the Woods on Broadway and in its final workshop. Other theater work early in his career included directing shows at Playwrights Horizons and the New York Theater Workshop, as well as early incarnations of Marcia Norman and Lucy Simon's The Secret Garden and Jonathan Larson's Superbia. He then went on to a major career as a documentary filmmaker, producing the Oscar-nominated The War Room, the Emmy-nominated A Perfect Candidate, the Sundance Award-winning The September Issue, and the Peabody Award-winning Listen to Me, Marlin, The World According to Dick Cheney, and Thin. On television, he created such landmark programs as the Emmy-winning American High, Freshman Diaries, and 30 Days, as well as conceiving and directing the scripted series Nashville. He also directed the feature film If I Stay and created, wrote, directed, and produced the Webby Award-winning podcast The Oval Office Tapes. Cutler's most recent work includes Belushi, Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry, and the Apple Plus series Dear, which has profiled icons such as Spike Lee, Gloria Steinem, Misty Copeland, Stevie Wonder, and Viola Davis. I'm a big fan of all the work you've done since Into the Woods, so I know how busy you are, and I'm extremely grateful that you would chat with me. I appreciate that it was so long ago, and I'm sure your memories are hazy. I think the fact that you were, you're younger now than the people that were the, you know, quote unquote grown-ups on the show at the time. And you were certainly young, and it was, you know, I would imagine somewhat of a formative experience. So I'm very curious to get, you know, the impressions that stayed with you and the memories over the years.
Of course.
And
I mean, it was as formative an experience as any I've had, and indirectly it led to the career I have as a documentary filmmaker, because Wendy Ettinger, who is the sister of Heidi Ettinger, who was one of the producers, and her then husband Rocco Landisman, who's another one of the producers and one of the theater owners and partner in the Dodgers, who managed the production. Wendy was my producing partner on The War Room, which was the first film that I ever produced, and she was the person who I reached out to when I thought, you know, there was a documentary to be made about Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign, and I wouldn't have known her had I not had a friendship forged through Into the Woods with Heidi and Rocco. So there you go.
Wow. Well, what Academy Awards later, and then it all started with Into the Woods. Tell me, going back before you were working on Into the Woods, were you like a Sondheim nerd already? What was your background when this came into your life?
You know, it's funny. I was a theater kid who had graduated from Harvard a few years earlier. and or maybe a couple of years earlier, and was working at the American Repertory Theatre in Cambridge, Bob Brustein's theatre at the time. And Bob was a mentor of mine, and you know, for us, Broadway was the devil in a way. And not that, I don't want to overstate it, but Broadway was the commercial theater was the enemy. We worshipped at the altar of the American Regional Theater and the not-for-profit theater, and commerce was the last thing we were taught to care about. In fact, Bob had rules about, you know, allowing the New York Times to even come and see productions at the American Repertory Theater. But he also was the mentor to Rocco Landisman and Heidi Ettinger, and who he had, I think yeah, Heidi had been at Yale as a design student, and Rocco had been at Yale as a dramaturgy student, and Bob was very important in their lives as well, and they were producing Into the Woods on Broadway and knew that James Lapine, the director of Into the Woods, needed an assistant, and they reached out to Bob to see if he knew any bright young aspiring directors who might be interested, and he recommended me. And I had been, in spite of my snobbery born of my relationship with Bob Brustein, I had been a fan of the musical theater, and as a high school student, and in my non-Harvard kind of heart, or my non-ART heart, the musical theater was incredibly important to me, and I had directed musicals in high school, and one of the people who worked at the community theater where I did my high school shows was a man named Michael Starobin. And
Wow.
Mike, yeah, and Michael was one of the older guys who was a, and it was a music theater a genius, and he would play in the orchestra. I directed the Three Penny Opera when I was in high school, and Michael Starobin was in the orchestra. And
Wow.
so too was Phil Granger, who you would know as the flugelhorn player in the orchestra of Sunday in the Park with George, because Phil and Michael were besties, and Michael would go on to become the other orchestrator, the non-John Tunick
Right.
orchestrator of Stephen Sondheim's work. And Michael also was the music director who worked very closely with a young, brilliant composer lyricist named Bill Finn. And one night, Michael said, "Come to New York." I was a junior in high school. He said, "Come to the city. There's a 10 o'clock performance of a musical called In Trousers
Wow.
by this guy I've been working with." And I went, my friends and I, we went into the city. We went to Playwrights Horizons on 42nd Street, and before the transformation, long before the transformation, in the old theater upstairs, even before the old theater was renovated. And we climbed the stairs, and we saw In Trousers starring Chip Zion
Mary
starring
Testa.
Chip and Mary Testa and Alison Fraser. And I remember it like it was yesterday. I mean, it was a life-changing experience. Well, Michael Starobin then went on with Bill Finn and James Lapine to do March of the Falsettos,
Sure.
which was a revelation in the music theater world, and a Frank Rich hit. You know, like a hit, like I don't think any of us had ever. Frank was, stretching his, what would you say, flexing his muscles to make that, to recognize the genius of March of the Falsettos, which was in a way, a sequel to In Trousers. You know, it was the same characters, and Anyway, I took an interest in the work of James Lapine as a result of that. And I remembered him as well as the writer and director of a play my parents had brought me to see, which was called Table Settings. Mm-hmm. When I had seen that, maybe I was in ninth or 10th grade. And, you know, it was a Jewish family sitting around the dinner table being Jews. And it was hilarious. And it was our family, you know, it was everyone's family. I mean, James captured something incredible then. And so I was really intrigued enough to ignore my, you know, my snobbery and go to New York and take the meeting with James Lapine and Heidi Landisman to be James's assistant. And you know, I guess the meeting went well because he offered me the job and that's how I got involved.
So this was, they had just done the show at the Old Globe in San Diego.
That's right.
And they were getting ready for Broadway. Do you remember like what?
For a workshop. It was in August. Yes. It was an August workshop in which Betty Buckley was starring as the witch. Most of the rest of the cast was assembled, as I recall. And Betty and her dog were a presence. I was in charge of walking the dog frequently, and we did this. We did it. Maybe it was a 2 week workshop, 2-3 week workshop. At the end of which the opening on Broadway was kind of confirmed. Although everybody knew that that was coming.
So I'm so curious about this workshop.
It was like a backer's audition because, you know, workshops in those days were different union rules and they were a lot more loosey-goosey, but it was, we were down on, you know, in Michael Bennett's studio, down on Broadway and on Lower Broadway. And, you know, I worked in the theater and I had done a lot with Bob and I had worked at the ART for a couple of years and, but there we were on Broadway. It was a whole other thing. Yeah.
So, I mean, I've heard different things about this workshop and of course, you know, there's nothing about it, anywhere online, which is part of the reason that I'm doing this podcast is because you know, the story of this landmark musical is somewhat lost to the ages. But so I understand that, as you said, it was a couple of weeks in August. And, I mean, Broadway previews started in September. So that was real close.
Oh, then maybe was it in August then? Maybe it was
well,
in June.
It could have been July. But, I mean, it was...
Yeah, it was. There was about 6 weeks of Broadway. Broadway previews started in September. That's right, because the invited dress was on my birthday, which was September 28th. So there you go. I do remember that. And so, yeah, maybe we started rehearsing mid-August. So maybe the workshop was the June, early July, and there were a few weeks off.
That's yeah.
That makes sense. And during that period, one day James called and said that Bernadette had, something had changed in her schedule, or maybe something had changed with Betty. We knew that Bernadette became available in a way that she hadn't. Roses were being sent, lots and lots of roses were being sent to Bernadette.
This is amazing. You've already unlocked a door for me because, you know, one of the great things that I've wondered about from the beginning of this is how is it that the Sondheim-Lapine collaboration on the heels of the Pulitzer Prize winning success of Sunday in the Park with George, a personal triumph for Bernadette Peters in that role that, you know, she's still iconic in all these years later. And through 3 years of readings and workshops and a production at the Old Globe, weeks before Broadway previews, they were in a workshop with Betty Buckley. How is it that Bernadette was such a last minute thing? And for you to say that something changed in her schedule where she became available.
That's my memory is that she became available. And also my memory, not too specific, was that everything wasn't smooth sailing with Betty.
Yes.
My memory of it was that there was a certain amount of conflict and frustration, but it's hard. I wish I had a story to tell She was very nice to me, you know, but I was walking the dog. So, but I, it was like, it wasn't all, everything changed when suddenly Bernadette was available.
Yes.
And the certainty, I mean, the certainty of it. And of, I mean, look, they just had this incredible triumph, with Sunday. And, so why wouldn't it why wouldn't everybody have, you know, taken a huge sigh of relief? But more than that, incredible excitement. I mean, James was,
yeah.
I didn't know him well at the time, but he was, you know, he was probably as excited as any single, you know, moment work related in his life. I mean, it was a big deal. And I remember Rocco telling me he was sending, you know, 3 dozen roses to Bernadette. Obviously negotiation had to happen and everything like that. But once they knew, and there you go.
I mean, so aside from even the Betty aspect of it, like with Bernadette, because there had been people talking about, some people had floated the idea that she had been obviously considered, and even talked about how she had come to see the show, not only to this workshop in the summer, mm-hmm. but even in San Diego. And that there, on one hand, people were saying that she would never do this part because it was too small. And then other people said, no, that the intention, aside from casting, just dramaturgically, was always to make it, to beef up the role more.
Well, the songs to come.
Yeah.
Listen, the bar had been set, as we know, about the songs to come. I'm working now with James. I'm making a film, an adaptation of his, a documentary based on his oral history of the making of Sunday in the Park.
Oh, incredible!
So yeah, we're using all the tapes that the interviews that he did for the oral history. So it's very, very exciting, and we're it's unannounced, but it's happening. You know, listen, the legend had been established. I mean, Steve showing up twice, not first in the workshop for act one, and then during previews for the final songs in act two, that he delivered. That was always kind of woven in. Steve's still writing. Steve's gonna, and The Last Midnight was the, right, was the final song that
yeah.
came, and waiting for The Last Midnight was, you know, and the expectation was that these songs were going to be as show changing as they were in Sunday. So that they were going to add to Bernadette's character, and to, you know, so there was that. My recollection is that, yes, dramaturgically, it was always anticipated that the role would beef up. And certainly when Bernadette took it. And it, by the way, this may have been part of the conflict with Betty. She may have been, you know, she may, I don't know, I don't, again, I don't remember enough to remember, was she complaining about the size of the role. But the other thing about Bernadette that I remember is that though the role was small, you know, James would say to me, just wait until the audience comes, just wait and see what happens. And I was like, what? And he said, you'll see. And first preview, it was like, she took over the show. And the songs weren't, the new song wasn't in at that point.
Yeah.
And it just was the way she, I mean, she grew 10 feet. It was, I had never seen anything like it. It's theater star magic.
Yeah.
And she was larger than life, and the audience response I don't want to say it was deafening, that would overstate it, but it was like a roar of laughter when she came out, and you know, and the transformation at the end of act one, right, or whatever,
yeah.
the second midnight, I think
right.
the transformation No, it's a Third Midnight Transformation. She comes out and she's young again. I mean, I had never experienced something like it, and certainly had never experienced it in the workshop or in the rehearsal room, or obviously during tech rehearsals. But when there was an audience, she grew the part just by virtue of being Bernadette.
It's interesting. I mean, there's a YouTube video of like an invited rehearsal for the press still at 890 Broadway.
Wow.
And watching Bernadette do like the greens rap in that sequence, having been so familiar with her performance on the broadcast video and on the cast recording, where she's so hilarious. Yeah. And it's much less funny in this. And it was interesting to think that was something that, and I think partly from the audience itself, as you describe, and certainly I would imagine in rehearsal too. But because I've often...
She was working, you know, yeah. She was making it. She was making it and she knew, and she had a director who knew, who trusted her. And the reason James would say something to me is because I probably was asking.
Yeah.
You know, is this the performance?
Yeah.
But I remember more than one conversation where he was like, just wait. It happens when it happens, which is of course a great, great lesson for me.
You know, people are always asking me if I'm on Ozempic, and let me tell you, I do not mind them asking me that, but I'm not on Ozempic. They especially ask me that when they see me eating dessert or desserts or all the crap I eat when I'm out. But my secret is that when I'm home, when I'm by myself, I'm eating Factor. Factor sends me restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever I am. No prepping, no cooking, no cleanup except for like my fork. And now you can enjoy Factor Meals too. Go to factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 and use code giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off. That's code giantsinthesky50 at factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I'm curious about how the intentions for the role shifted. I mean, I have not succeeded in getting Betty to talk to me for this podcast yet, but she did an extensive interview for Eddie Shapiro's book, Nothing Like a Dame, where she talked about this experience, obviously her perspective.
What'd she say?
You know, and how she chooses to portray it or whatever. But she talked only of artistic differences. I mean, she talked about how much she respected Lapine and what great friends they are and to this day.
Oh, yeah. And he, you know, the more legend, but he's, as the story goes, right? He was a huge help to her with her character in Cats.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah, which was
a great friend to her.
But she talks in that book about essentially saying that they saw the role in different ways, and that the ultimate, with some satisfaction, I imagine on her part, as she describes it, the way the role ultimately was came home to what Betty had conceived. And she talks about Lapine seeing the witch Rapunzel relationship as a lesbian relationship, and she thought it was an abusive mother. And at first I thought, when I read that book, she misunderstood what James Lapine said, or he meant it in some sort of allegorical way or something. But then watching the like bootleg videos from the old Globe production with Ellen Foley, it did seem more like that. And of course I realized that the witch is not Rapunzel's mother. It's actually could be considered like her ward, like Sweeney Todd, like with the judge with Joanna. And so I started to think, oh, maybe Betty was actually describing what Lapine had in mind at that time, and it had shifted. Do you remember anything along those lines being in the discussion?
I don't. I'm sure James can speak to it. I have no...
He was very tight-lipped about Betty. I don't know if he was being diplomatic, but I didn't get much from him on that.
I'm sure he was. Listen, I'm sure it was a difficult... It couldn't have been an easy transition. It wasn't, you know... As I say, there was absolute certainty that my recollection is that there was absolute certainty that this was the right thing to do and an opportunity that couldn't be passed and that it was best for everything, best for the show. And of course, that turned out to be the case. And those changes are always difficult in any, you know.
I'm interested, but I don't remember.
I don't remember the dramaturgy of the witch's character.
Yes.
In the context you're talking about.
Or even just broadly speaking, I mean, we talked about the comedy that Bernadette seems to have developed in rehearsal and then, of course, in front of the audience. When you would have those conversations with Lapine, was the intention for there to be a lot of comedy in that character? And it just,
you know, because it's more than the comedy. It's the connection. It's that on some level, she's the, you know, look, you're relating to everybody in that show. You're the Cinderella in us all is relating to Kim, and the Jack in us all, or the Jack's mother are relating, you know, to Bryn. What was her
Barbara?
Jack's
Bryn.
Mother, Barbara Bryn, bless her, and to Ben, and you're relating to Chip and Joanna. You're entering through them all, but somehow. It was Bernadette who kind of became, in a way, a conduit. It was a connection to the audience that meant laughter, but it also meant pathos in the second act. So it's and when the song came in spite of the fact that I don't believe it was compared to the impact that the songs in Sunday had when they came in. She made it certainly as great and impactful as it could possibly be. And that's what happened. So it wasn't just that the comedy was being developed. It was all of it. It was all of that star power that was forming.
Okay, and I want to ask you so many things about all the changes to the show and everything, but so forgive me if I'm belaboring this one cast.
No, we can talk about all of it. To the extent that I remember it, I'm happy to talk about
it. Thank you. I very much appreciate that. Because this is an area where there's been a lot of different things that have been said to me, ranging from another thing Betty said in that Eddie Shapiro book is that negotiations broke down and for her to do the show on Broadway, and that she was then sort of shunned in the business afterward for not having taken the last best offer, like that she thought she was too good for what they were asking her to do, and that, you know, that was high and mighty of her or whatever. The opposite, people have claimed absolutely not. Betty was fired and her contract was terminated. And I do know that, just to ring a bell for you, I don't know if this is in your current memory, but something I learned doing this was that for Broadway, this is as an aside, Burke Moses had been cast as Rapunzel's prince. And then when Bob Westenberg was busy with matinees and stuff of the production of The Crucible, I think he was doing in D.C., they said for the workshop, Burke would play the wolf and Cinderella's prince, and his understudy Jeff Blumenkrantz would be Rapunzel's prince. And then they were so unhappy with Burke that they fired him, and he was paid off his Broadway contract, as he told me. And then Chuck Wagner, who had done Rapunzel's prince at the Old Globe, was cast for Broadway. But so, you know, according to the people that claim Betty was fired, presumably that was the case. And then, I mean, as a matter of fact, one person even claimed, that cast member, that that Bernadette was not at the first Broadway rehearsal, that Betty started Broadway rehearsals, was fired, and then Bernadette came in. And I kept saying, maybe you think that because it was the same studio at 890 Broadway. Maybe it had the same tape on the floor. Maybe it's it's hard to remember. You were already in costume fittings during the workshop, so maybe it seems in your memory. Leahy said, no, no, absolutely not. Bernadette didn't start rehearsals. And of course, it was 1987. Nowadays, playbill.com, everybody would have been announced, you know, before it all went down. But so do you have a memory of the timing, for example, of when?
My memory is that it happened between the workshop and the and rehearsals. That, if you told me it didn't, I wouldn't fight with you because it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
But my memory of what happened now, almost 40 years ago, is that between the workshop and the start of rehearsals for the Broadway production, the change was made and flowers were sent. Those are the things I remember. And I remember James being very excited about it. The Dodgers being very
sure
about it.
Understand. I mean, in addition to the triumph in Sunday in the Park, the season before Into the Woods, Bernadette had won the Tony in Song and Dance. I mean, they're, you know, and couldn't.
And on.
So, and then a lot of people have talked about how they were given, it was two separate contracts, but they were given them at the same time for the workshop and for the Broadway production, which kind of seems to like support the Betty, you know, negotiation breaking down that other people contradict. Is it possible in your mind that Betty's telling the truth and that negotiation?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have any opinion.
Got
whatsoever.
You.
I'm sorry. I don't.
No, please.
You're reminding me that when it came time to figure out what they were going to pay me, Michael David sat me down. He was like, now this isn't the subsidized regional theater. We're not going to be able to afford the kind of money you were making. You know, I was probably making $300 a week, you know.
Too rich for his life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're just trying to put on a show here. Yeah, I do remember that.
Oh, Broadway.
But I don't remember anybody else's. I don't remember anything about other than what I've told you about
the
change.
And then branching off from that change into the actual substantive changes to the show. One thing that I've heard from a lot of people, one more question about the transition. Several people have mentioned in between the workshop and the first Broadway rehearsal that there was a reading one afternoon at a townhouse where it was the entire cast, including Bernadette, which was where many cast members found out. Danielle Ferland said that was when she found out Bernadette was the witch. She came to this reading at a townhouse. Betty wasn't there. Bernadette was there. Paul Ford has talked about this townhouse reading. Does that ring a bell at all?
Yeah, maybe. And maybe. Also, and Rocco made a little speech beforehand where he talked about his, as I'm remembering it, Rocco made a speech welcoming everybody. Maybe it was a backers audition or something. And it's fun, you know, it's nothing I've thought about in 40 years, but he made a speech about what it was like growing up in St. Louis as a lover of the theater and what this production meant to him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what my memory of that day that's coming back is.
And then also about the presentations in that workshop, I've heard different things. There was three different performances of the workshop or two. There was different endings where the baker's wife died or didn't die, she died.
Maybe, yeah. That all rings true.
Yeah.
That's as much as I can give you, but that all rings true. There were lots of changes. There were changes every night. James would come in every day with pages that needed to be typed and that was, you know, one of my jobs. But he, you know, his day was halfway done when rehearsal would end. Because he wasn't just the director. He was, you know, he was the writer as well. And then he was staging scenes. But so much of the workshop was about the script work.
Yeah.
And exploring different changes. But I don't remember the various permutations.
And so talk to me about the process of you working with James, like you described. So would he give you handwritten script pages and you would type those? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that is my memory. And I would type them there. You know, there was a early Apple, you know, an early Macintosh somewhere.
Yeah.
and a dot matrix printer.
Right.
And the pages would come out and right. And was it Frank Hartenstein was the stage manager,
yeah.
right? Frank
yeah.
and Jonna Murray, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, these were, you know, I was a kid. I was a kid. These guys were the pros. And so, you know, I'm sure it was no different than anybody else as an assistant. I was typing up the pages, distributing them. You know, my favorite, James knows that I reference this a lot and have over the years, the fact that one of the great lessons he taught me was that if he needed something done, he would say, you know, go down to the wig shop and tell them I'm upstairs yelling and I'm throwing things around because I need the wigs, you know, and you don't tell them I'm not, you know, just tell them I am. And I'd go down and say, James is freaking out. He's freaking out. And I was like, that's so smart because he doesn't waste any extra, you know, he doesn't have to freak out. All he has to do is tell me to tell people that he is freaking out. And so I employ that trick. It's a good one.
Another thing that Betty supposedly complained about, and that was the song Boom Crunch that came before Last Midnight came in, which I understand happened during previews. And other people have described Bernadette struggling with Boom Crunch also. And that there was like, was there a sense that Boom Crunch had to go? Did you think that, you know, from the beginning, was that what they were talking about, that that was a problem, that song?
My big memory is that was just, again, waiting for, is the song in today? Is the song in today? And I think it literally came at the given the rehearsal schedule during previews and when the critics were coming, it came the last second. But I don't remember debate over a Boom Crunch or yeah.
Because like in the wonderful Putting It Together Lapine book on Sunday in the Park with George, talking about the songs you referenced, Move On and Lesson Number 8, I think Children and Art maybe also, that there was blank. You know, that there was just like a song comes here.
Yes, that's right.
But, song.
Right. But we didn't have that option. Or if we had the option, that's not what. That's right. The songs replaced other songs.
Yeah.
Or the song replaced another song. Right.
And then the other thing that I guess is sort of legendary at this point is the song Second Midnight that, you know, I had that bonus track on the reissued CD for years and just ignored it because I thought it was just going to be the little, what, you know, the platitudes, you know, for 90 seconds. But, you know, apparently it's this 8-minute elaborate, like full company musical number that was only in for one performance. Do you remember anything about that?
Nope. And I don't.
I have to really send you don't. That track.
But I will tell you that the original preview, the night, you know, the invited dress was about 3.5 hours long.
Wow.
Things were, yeah, it was well over 3 hours. And there were issues with, you know, how long are we going to keep the theater open? And, you know, the producers
yeah.
were like, we got to get out of there. By the show didn't end until, you know, I believe we were in overtime, certainly all through the preview period, but maybe even afterwards. And then there were issues with the giant's head and there were previews where, you know, performances had to be stopped. There was once, and James would go out and, you know, make curtain speeches while we figured out the technology and once it happened on a day when he wasn't there and I can't remember. He had said to me, if it happens on Sunday, I won't be there. You go out, make a speech. Just tell everybody, say, my name is RJ and I'm from Great Neck and you'll be fine. And so I went out and I said, my name is RJ and I'm from Great Neck. Everyone did. There you go. But I don't remember that number. But again, you know, the rehearsal process and the preview process was it was culturally understood that Steve was going to write through this period and James was going to write through this period around what Steve wrote. And that's what previews were going to be like because they had been through it. They had been through it and it had worked. So there was a lot of faith. There was also a lot of pressure. There was also an enormous amount of expectation. And when the day came and passed and the song or songs hadn't come in, the pressure was growing and it was Dave and we were waiting. But that's, you know, I was one of the waiting, so I can't tell you more than what it was like to be waiting.
And I mean, when you talk about, like, certainly I imagine one of the many boons of having Bernadette leading the company is her having successfully had this, you know, seemingly harmonious collaboration with Sondheim and Lapine just on their previous show is a rock of, if anyone's going to have been there, done that, and, you know, exude good vibes, it would be Bernadette Peters in that situation that could otherwise be hairy and, you know, tense backstage. What about, like, on the other side? Like, was there a lot of producerial confidence and support? What was the temperature?
I mean, I think everybody was, listen, it's a Broadway musical and it's an original Broadway musical. And, you know, everyone is subject to the potential of a flop, you know, of a failure, and everybody's, so the, I don't want to, the environment was tense, but everybody was working. There was certainly a lot of love. James was particularly good at kind of keeping the company. And it's funny because of course there was legend, as James describes in his own book about Sunday, you know, there was a lot of conflict with the cast and that didn't exist. There was tension between them. I mean, Chip and Joanna, you know, you don't want to stand at any point between the two of them because they could be fighting at any moment about things. They were like a married couple, and they were performing at the absolute peak of their collective powers and they were crushing it. Constantly crushing it, and they loved each other, but there was, you know, there it was intense. It was all intense, and certainly the producers wanted a shorter show. They wanted a second act that was the something different. You know, there were, you know, they have to speak for themselves, but you know, it was not a mystery that the producers felt that they had questions about the second act. And was it too long and was it too dark and was it too, you know, and as I said before, Rocco's not just a producer of legend. He was a dramaturg of strong opinion. So, you know, you would, and all those guys were, they were used to being, you know, they were smart and all that, but James had his vision and he knew what he wanted and he knew what he was going for. And he was the writer and this is the theater, you know? And so he was in charge. They opinions were expressed, but he made the decisions. And as I say, I remember a lot, you know, those days were long. They were so long. And then you'd start up again, you know, you'd get a few hours sleep and you'd start up again the next day. And in the preview period, maybe it was 4 or 6 weeks, but it was very intense. And there was not a lot of certainty, but there was there was so much greatness all the time. And there was the first act, which worked and which, you know, and wasn't waiting for songs. And there were these incredible, I mean, you know, we got to see Kim Crosby every night singing, you know,
On
the Steps of the Palace, or Ben singing Giants in the Sky.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, you know? And Danny was incredible. Everybody was great. And there was Bernadette and Chip. I mean, on and on. I mean, and the princes, you know, who were hilarious. And so it wasn't like people were like, oh no, this show won't work. There was no question about that. It was like, but they, you know, they were all chasing, as always, greatness. And so that's where the tension was. And audiences, you knew the audience loved it, but you also knew that, you know, when it was long before it came down in time, that it was that they would grow tired as the night grew on during the preview period. So,
I mean, for a lot of the like younger fans today, it may be surprising that the show actually got somewhat mixed reviews, particularly from Frank Rich, even though he'd been such a...
Yeah, it was a disappointment. It was a disappointment. Yeah.
What do you remember the sort of company, or not so much with the cast necessarily, but the producers, ad meetings? Were you privy to those kind of conversations with James about moving forward past that?
No. I mean, I stayed. I'd go a lot, and but it wasn't. I wasn't working after the show opened. I'm trying to remember, you know, this was a time when all that mattered was a Frank Rich review, and there hadn't been examples, you know, the way that there have been examples now, right? Didn't Wicked get bad reviews, you know?
Yeah.
So there you go. And there are a couple of other shows that you know have survived the New York Times not loving it. There wasn't no such thing in that era. Frank was the high executioner, and if he gave you the thumbs up, as he did with Sunday, you know, you know, I think it was a second review, right, of his that really did it with Sunday.
Yeah.
It wasn't. Somebody else had reviewed it, and then he came in. Whatever happened, he helped make that show. And with Into the Woods, it was a mixed review. It was full of his love.
Yeah.
I remember John Simon being particularly cruel, but John Simon was always cruel.
Right.
But you know, God knows it survived it. I mean, that shows that's who hasn't experienced Into the Woods in their life multiple times. And most people have been in it, because that the school version of that show is like, it's a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Will probably always be so. And these, and you know, as you know, as recently as last year, you know, productions that really touch the heart, move the heart, and resonate with people deeply.
Did you say that you were done working on it after opening night?
That's my memory, is that I didn't, you know, I'd go by and I'd spend time and I'd say, and I, you know, I don't remember taking notes, for instance. Mm-hmm. After previews.
And so you weren't involved?
My parents came.
Yeah.
James bought them a pair of tickets. But I don't remember working after the open.
Not with the replacement cast or the filming or anything like that.
The filming, yes. I remember. I know I was there for the filming of, I was definitely there for the filming of Sunday in the Park, because that was during this whole time that the Sunday filmed final performances. I do remember being there for Into the Woods, but the taping of it, because James directed, but I don't remember too many specifics about it.
I mean, and one thing I want to get more from James on, but maybe you'll remember, it's interesting to me because he didn't direct the cameras for Sunday in the Park.
That's right.
And certainly it seems part of the reason that Into the Woods is so perfectly preserved is because he directed it with such intelligence and specificity and knowledge, care, you know. But do you remember?
Yeah, I did work. I remember working that week, or because I came back to it.
And you had not yet started to become a filmmaker yourself at that point, right?
No, I was a young theater director. I moved on to the Secret Garden, also produced by the Rocko. Dodgers.
Yeah.
And Heidi. It was really Heidi's show. And
designed by him.
And I was designed by Heidi, and I directed. We went to Saratoga and did a workshop, and then we went down to Virginia and did a production, and then Heidi took me out for a champagne lunch, got me drunk as a skunk, and told me she was replacing me with Susan Schulman. So that was my experience. But you know listen, again, you're talking about this. I was 25, 26 years old. Yeah. I hadn't even. This was one of the very. That was. This was my first New York experience, and then Secret Garden was maybe my second or third. So it was all pretty good.
I was curious, like in terms of like Lapine, because then he went on to direct a couple of movies shortly after this, and Impromptu was very shortly after this. I was wondering if you remember if there was any sort of calculus when he was going to direct the filming of Into the Woods. Was this part of
his career expansion and aspiration? Kind of I don't remember us talking about it much at all. I did work. We were working together. Impromptu was filmed when Falsetto Land was running off Broadway. So back to James and Bill Finn, and I maintained that show for him while he was in France shooting Impromptu. But that's a whole other podcast, isn't
it? Yes. Yes, it
is. The falsetto trilogy. And that's my life story, from In Trousers through Falsetto Land into Falsettos, all those things. But I don't, I don't, you know, storytelling, and you can imagine why James would have been attracted to filmmaking narrative filmmaking, as he still is. By the way, he's also a documentary filmmaker and has made a couple of great films, and he and I are working together on a documentary that he's directing. So that's different than the one I'm making about Sunday. So
curious.
He's an artist. He's expressing himself always in all ways.
Always and always. Well, I am very much looking forward to your Sunday in the Park with George documentary. I think certainly that book, putting it together, was the inspiration for me to do this podcast, hungering for that kind of granular oral history of Into the Woods. And I'm very excited to see that project and everything else you do, and so grateful to you for chatting with me about this.
It's my great pleasure, and thank you for inspiring me to have all these memories, because it was a formative experience in all of our lives. And this is, by the way, one of the what I think is so moving about putting it together about James's book is that it's written from the perspective of older people remembering a moment in their lives that was formative, but during which they had no idea it was so formative. They were taking it for granted. They had no idea what they were in the middle of. And now, as they're remembering it, they realize, of course, they were in the middle of something so special. And for me, that's what Into the Woods was. You know, you're talking, they're like, you know, sitting around with James and Steve and James's, I mean, in Steve's townhouse, you're experiencing it all in the moment. You know, the friendship that Steve showed to me for years, coming to see my shows, sending notes afterwards. You know, when he and John Weidman wrote Assassins and they needed to put it on their feet for a couple weeks workshop over at Playwrights Horizons, they asked me to do it. You know, it was very clear I wouldn't be asked to direct it, but there I got to direct the first, 70% of it for 2 weeks with this incredible cast. And, you know, and there were so many things. And for a kid who was, 25 years old, not even, I was, you know, not even doing the thing that was going to, I would find as my life's calling, but something that was so formative and defined me in so many ways as an artist and a film and a storyteller and a director and all those things and a person. It was an amazing experience. So I'm grateful to you for asking questions about it. It's, you know,
absolutely.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, we should all take a lesson from that and live in our golden ages, our formative experiences in real time. Appreciate
right.
them.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, RJ.
And,
thank you so much. Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went Into the Woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Look out for episode 50 with Bernadette Peters, the original witch.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.